Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Wake Up to Purpose with your host, John Stanko. This program will help you find your purpose and, more importantly, how to make your purpose work for you. And now, here's John Stanko.
Hello out there in Internet Radio Land. This is John Stanko, your host for another edition of Wake Up to Purpose. And we have my friend, colleague Felicia Lynch waiting on hold, calling us from the Caribbean. Going to talk to us about leadership issues and her book, The Invisible Leader, and a whole lot of other things that I'm sure we will touch on, and how we met and how we've stayed connected. But I do trust you are doing well. I always want to say this is day such and such of the pandemic, but I can't do that because it really had an indefinite start, and it varied from country to country and place to place. Of course, now we're seeing that there was probably a case of the COVID-19 in California long before, or way before we were even talking about it in the United States. So it is a fascinating time. We've never seen anything like it. And not only do we know what day, we don't know what day it is of the pandemic, we don't know how many more days there are to go. And I talked to my daughter this morning, and they are talking in Virginia about not resuming classes, face-to-face classes, until January. And so that means that young people, students, would be home learning online from between now for another 8 months. And so that does not bring joy to many parents' hearts, I'm sure. And so that even when the economy is resumed, if that's possible, then you're going to have parents who have childcare issues. And so I've been posting that this is going to have serious implications. Obviously, it already has. But my point is, it's going to last longer than we hope. And so each of us has to decide and determine how we respond, what it is we're going to do, and what is it that we do if we don't have available to us what we had before we got into this, and we have nothing to go back to. And that's a difficult question that many people do not want to address, because they're hoping that they'll be able to I'll get another job. And but if there are just a lot of implications, and this show isn't about the implications. This show is about helping you embrace your purpose and come to the realization that God wants you to know it, God wants you to fulfill it, and therefore there could be some economic return around you embracing your purpose. But that's a big step from where some of us are, and that's why I'm coming to you. I fired up the old blog radio machine, and here we've been coming to you now for the fourth week. I want to remind you, I launched my ministry app, Purpose Quest International. My goal is to get 5 people to download the app every day between now and the end of the year. And that's not, I mean, when I say get them to download it, I hope they would see the benefit of downloading it. I had a Zoom meeting, who of us hasn't had a Zoom meeting during this time at home? Had a Zoom meeting with one of my former graduate students and somebody I think it's fair to say I've coached a bit over the years. And he said he had downloaded it and he's wanted to write a book, and he watched the sessions on creativity, and he watched 2 of my sessions on how to publish a book. That's the very reason I paid for and continue to pay a monthly subscription fee, so that you can have easier access to my resources, which I believe in, which I believe can help you. So I'm challenging my Facebook audience, my LinkedIn readers, my Twitter followers that download the app And I promise I won't harass you. I will send you at least one daily push notification of something that I'm doing. I put one out about an hour ago concerning this show. And I'm writing, right before we went on the air, I was writing my next entry in my Purpose Study Bible. So tomorrow I'll send a notification out on the app that that is available to read. And that's how I hope to use it. Now, speaking of tomorrow, my show tomorrow, I'll have my friend Bill Rhodes back on, and Bill will be interviewing me. But if you have a question that you would like to have me address on the show, please send it to me. You can send me a message on Facebook, or you could send it to johnstanko@gmail.com. Also, you can call in the show, and this, I hope, won't be your 15 minutes of fame that Andy Warhol talked about, but the number is on the link for the show. When you listen to it, when you bring up that link, the guest call-in number is right there, and I've had people call in, and so tomorrow I'll make this available to you if you want to ask me a question. The number is 515-605-9729. But again, that is on the blogtalkradio.com/JohnStanko network page. And so please call in and feel free to ask your questions. Or if you won't be listening live, and but you'd still want to listen later and have me address a question, I will be glad to do so. Those of you who follow me on Facebook know I am blasting away on Facebook every morning and putting things out there to provoke and to challenge and to get people thinking. And it's always fascinating to see what people respond to and what they don't respond to, because there are some things I think, oh, this is so profound. And I mean, people, it's just, oh, they just yawn. But then I put other things that I think, well, I've talked about this before. People probably know this. And boom, it just goes. It really touches people. And the one for today is where I posted, Paul made tents to earn money, but he never introduced himself as a tent maker. And that's always fascinated me. He has 13 letters in the New Testament. And if Luke hadn't told us that Paul was a tent maker, we'd never know, because Paul never talked about it. He always introduced himself as an apostle. So I wrote that, saying, you know, so what? Well, I put for the personal application for each of us is, don't derive your identity from what you do to make money. Identify yourself by what gives you joy and produces fruit for him and his kingdom. And that seems to really grabbed hold of people. It's got 15 shares and 96 people who have liked or responded to it. And yeah, I do watch those. I am at the same time, I don't think it determines what I'm going to put on, but I'm watching to see what God is using to touch people. And so tomorrow when I do a Facebook Live session, I'm going to focus on that concept and drill down a little more deeply in that. So, but at any rate, let's go ahead and complete our next exercise here, which is our standard part of our opening. And since I've been back on the air, and that is to read Psalm 91, and then we'll bring our guest on, Felicia Lynch. But yesterday I read from the Wycliffe translation. Every day I'm reading from a different translation. We haven't run out of translations yet. And the Wycliffe translation is from 1382. And so let me read you this. More than two centuries before the King James Version, which was 1611, Oxford professor and theologian John Wycliffe undertook the first ever English translation of Scripture. The hand-printed early version of the Wycliffe Bible, which first appeared in 1382, offered a literal translation of the Latin Vulgate. It was the first time the common people had access to Scripture in their language in more than 1,300 years. But 13 years later, by 1395, Wycliffe's friend John Purvey had amended the often unwieldy translation into a later version, which was easier to read but kept much of the poetry of the early version. The version known today as the Wycliffe Bible was widely distributed throughout England all more than half a century before Gutenberg invented his printing press. So yesterday we read the original from John Wycliffe. Today we're going to read John Purvey's edits of Psalm 91. So let's go ahead and read that. I'll read that to you. Psalm 91, "He who dwelleth in the shelter of the Most High shall live under the protection of the God of heaven. He shall say to the Lord, Thou art my defender and my refuge, my God, I trust in thee. For he shall save me from the hunter's snare and from a sharp word. With his feathers he shall make a shadow for thee, and thou shalt have hope under his wings. His faithfulness shall surround thee like a shield. Thou shalt not fear the terror in the night, nor an arrow flying in the day, nor the pestilence going in darkness, nor the assailing of the plague at midday. 1,000 shall fall at thy side, and 10,000 at thy right side, but it shall not even come close to thee. Nevertheless, nevertheless, thou shalt see with mine eyes, yea, thou shalt see the punishment of the sinners. For thou hast made the Lord to be thy hope, yea, the Most High to be thy help. Evil shall not come to thee, and a scourge shall not come nigh to thy tabernacle. For God hath commanded his angels to be all around thee, so that they keep thee safe on all thy ways. They shall lift thee up with their hands, lest thou hurt thy foot on a stone. Thou shalt go upon a snake, and trample upon a lion and a dragon. For God said, He hoped in me, because he loved me, I shall save him. I shall defend him, for he knew my name. When he crieth to me, I shall answer him. I shall be with him in all his troubles. I shall rescue him, and I shall honor him. I shall fulfill him with length of days, that is, with a long life, and I shall give my salvation or my deliverance to him, and I shall save him. That is the edited version of 1395 of the Wycliffe Bible, and that was, as we said, a Bible distributed in England. And wouldn't you know it, we have somebody from England who's going to be on the show today. Felicia Lynch, welcome to Wake Up to Purpose.
Thank you, Dr. John. I'm very pleased to be here and to be hearing, all the great things that you've been, and seeing all the great things that you've been posting. It's been challenging me in this season, too.
Well, good. Well, I'm honored. And tell our listeners where you are calling from, and then tell us how the pandemic is impacting where you are.
So I'm calling from Barbados, island in the Eastern Caribbean, and, COVID has touched everywhere, and we are no different. So we are in what we call lockdown, which means that we are actually not supposed to be on the streets at all. We have moved to having allocated days based on the first letter of your surname to which you can go out. So my allocated days are on Tuesday afternoon and Friday morning. So you can go and do your essential shopping there. And other than that, we're in our homes. I can't say that, we're fortunate because, we're in a society and in a climate where it's warm and we can sit outside and et cetera. And so you don't feel too much like you're cooped up. But at the same time, it's a huge shift. It's a huge change. We're all grappling with, as you were saying, working remotely and, people who are trying to work remotely and have kids at home. I know exactly how that can be. So it's a difficult time, a difficult adjustment,
What would happen if you went out on a Wednesday or a Saturday? What would they do?
Well, we're not at the stage where we've got the military or the defense force on the streets or the police. But generally speaking, some shops are being more diligent than others. So if you turn up at the shop and they check your ID and it's not your day, then by rights they can refuse you entry.
Okay. All righty. And a lot of people would like to be stuck in Barbados, and here I am, Lord, send me. How are the food supplies? Are you able to get what you need?
Yes, I mean, for the most part, our food is imported, and so as time goes on, your things start to change. We are at the situation or the stage where just a funny little story, a bit of a God fighting yesterday. I haven't been in the supermarket, so yesterday was my day. I think it was yesterday, yeah. And I haven't been in the supermarket for, over 4 weeks, something like that, because the queues were just horrendous. And so I've been going to farm shops and things, and I'm so grateful for our local farmers and poultry farmers, etc. So what happened was I went to my usual farm shop, and then I thought, you know, there are some things that I really need to get from the supermarket, and I just thought, Lord, I just need to be able to get to the supermarket today and not spend the entire day there. So I was praying on my way as I was driving, and I got there, and miraculously, no queue. I was so grateful. So I was able to go in the store, and, you know, I think you have to be a little bit creative. You know, everything isn't available. Like I said, we import a lot of things. Ultimately, you know, I'm not a big canned food or tinned stuff anyway. I mean, try and do things as fresh as possible. So that kind of helps in this climate. But generally speaking, yeah, I mean, the odd things that you can't get, there's, you know, not so much olive oil on the shelves, or like I say, typical things that are imported. But you know what?
Yeah.
You learn to do without, right?
Yep.
Be content in all things.
Yeah, indeed. How'd you end up in Barbados? Is that your home, or how did you end up to be there?
So I'm, as I always like to say, I'm a child of the diaspora. I was born in the UK, but my dad is from Nigeria and my mum is from Barbados. And so I grew up coming to Barbados to see my grandmother and visit family, and always knew, just had, you know, that this is where I wanted to move to. And when I eventually got the chance after getting married, we decided to up sticks and move. And we've been here for the last 15 years. So, yeah, that's us.
Yeah. And why did you move there? What are you doing? And, you know, just talk to us about the work that that had brought you there, the work that you developed once you got there.
Well, it was interesting because we were reflecting the other day about how we got here. And I remember we came via Spain. So let me just explain that. We kind of knew we wanted to leave the UK, have a different life, better quality of life. And I can't say, I have to be honest, at that stage when we went to Spain, that we'd spent too much time asking the Lord, you know, is this the right move for us and whatever else. And so we went to Spain, and I never forget my husband saying, we weren't in Spain very long. I think we were there less than 18 months. And my husband, bear in mind, he'd lived in one house all his life, so 40-odd years or whatever it was. Then we got married. He moved to London. And then from London, we moved to Spain. And this is all in the space of, I think, 2 years. And so by now, he's kind of pulling his hair out with all these different moves. And then, you know, I just always had this, like I say, passion to want to move to Barbados. And he says, I'm not moving until, you know, unless the Lord tells me. So anyway, he got confirmation of that from the Lord, and we moved literally within a week of that, which is another long story. And I came wanting to do something different. I was a lawyer by profession, but had kind of grown out of that as I started to recognize what other skills and gifts I have, and you were instrumental in that journey, and I always want to thank you for that. And so had sort of deviated into HR and training, and so when I came, that was what I wanted to do. I wanted to set up a training company and deliver HR solutions and, you know, HR consultancy. But what actually happened in the midst of it, God has a different plan. I ended up being asked to come and do some work for a bank, which was great. I actually went for a job, and it was in sort of the learning and development department, so it should have been a dream thing, and it wasn't a fit. Anyway, after speaking to the head there, he said, you know, I can see you've got these other skills, and they created a role for me, which was wonderful. And for the next 2 years, that's what I did, and was going backwards and forwards. And then in an airport, of all things, I was in the airport in Barbados talking to a guy who was waiting for a colleague, and, you know, he was saying he's a consultant. I said, oh, so what do consultants do? And this kind of thing. We had this chat. And he said, you're asking some really insightful questions. And I said, well, I said I was a little bit bored. I'm a consultant too, but in doing different things. Anyway, he asked me if I would be interested in being in a project for government. Had never worked for government, tended to do stuff in the private sector. But he said, no, you'd be perfect because you bring and show up with different things, you know, with a different perspective. So I did my first assignment in Guyana. Ended up being in Guyana for 2 years, working with the government there as an advisor. And really, from then on, that's what I did. I became, you know, a government advisor, working on projects, you know, big, large-scale transformation projects, usually public service transformation for governments across the Caribbean. And I've never looked back, and I've really seen how the Lord has, you know, just used the work that I do to bring change. And, you know, even on an individual level, even if sometimes not on the wider, you know, national perspective that I would love to see.
Now, I want to make sure everybody caught this. You were an attorney, and that ran its course, and you wanted to change careers and do something else. Now, that's a big step.
Yeah.
I mean, I've talked to some people, you know, hey, listen, I went to all this training. I'm a doctor. I'm a lawyer. This is what I'm going to be. I hate it, but this is where I've invested, you know, myself, and doggone it, I'm going to make it work. You went in a different direction. Talk to us about that.
Yes. I mean, it's funny. I was just speaking to a friend today. You know, had a coaching session this afternoon, and around the fact that it can be really daunting, you know, like you say, to spend 25 years doing something and then, you know, think, oh gosh, did I make a mistake? But I was in a situation where I did love the law, still do, but there was something missing. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't something that I got up in the morning and thought, wow. You know, I'd always had, as I say in my book, this justice streak, you know, always had a passion for wanting to see justice done. And so law was a natural avenue for me. But when I got there, I realized it was less about justice and more about other things. And it just wasn't what I imagined, you know. Oftentimes, you know, stuff, you know, justice didn't prevail because of the system, et cetera. And, you know, it's a flawed system. So I thought I can spend the rest, you know, yes, I've, you know, studied hard and, you know, and this is what I've done for the last whatever it was, how many years, 7 years, 8 years or whatever it was. But I thought, you know, I've got skills that are transferable. And even if they're not, let me go out and get some other skills and find out. And one of the things that helped me to do that and to focus on that was I was growing in my faith. And I went on a retreat, one of your recent guests, Pastor Yvonne Brooks, was hosting the retreat with her Women of Purpose Ministries. And so I went on this retreat, and you happened to be the speaker. And for the first time, I went through, you know, what you might call a psychometric assessment or whatever. You did my DISC profile. And that was just so powerful for me. You know, when you did my DISC profile, I think I'd done one other because I'd decided to go and do an MBA to, you know, to develop some other skills. And but when you did my DISC profile, it really spoke to me in the sense that it helped me to lean into those elements of my personality and my character, my God-given design, that I wasn't using as a lawyer and that I hadn't really, you know, put any store by, because, you know, when we get into jobs, we tend to get pigeonholed. People see us as our job. So if they see you in a particular job, they think you're really great at that and that's what you do and that's who you become, versus there might be more to you. So it opened up a world of opportunity for me, and I thought I could spend the next 25 years doing something that, you know, one, I'm not passionate about, but two, actually doesn't lend itself as well as it could to these unique gifts and talents that the Lord has given me. And so I just said, I'm out. And the Lord has been faithful, you know, to use me and honor that.
Yeah. So what did you learn in the, you know, that DISC profile? And if you're just tuning in, we're talking to Felicia Lynch. She's calling in to us from Barbados, where she lives with her husband, Andrew, who is also an author, and she is a governmental consultant, and she's also the author of The Invisible Leader, Stepping Up, Stepping Out. But what was it in that session, Felicia, that was so dramatic? I mean, that really hit you between the eyes, that was such a revelation that set you on a new course?
You know, I can be analytical and, you know, objective, et cetera, which is what you need to be as a lawyer. And you lean into that. But I would always have this kind of thing in the back of my head when we did certain things that said, yeah, does it have to be done like that? And, you know, and I didn't find it easy to follow rules, and still don't. And, you know, like to be a bit more creative. And when you did my DISC profile, I discovered that I'm A high eye, which, you know, for those of you who don't know the disparate profile, the eye is very much some people call it influencer. It's the one that's really people oriented, and you know, for me, it was something that I had always known, but not really gotten that opportunity to lean into it in the work that I was doing. And also being a high D. So, you know, again, for those who don't know the disc, that's often termed sort of the dominant, not domineering, dominant. So very much sort of driven leadership, that type of thing. And again, always known that about myself, but not necessarily, leaned into it, for fear of, fear of, you know, I'm not the typical character who's seen as being a leader. You know, like I say in my book, I'm a 5 foot, two black woman and often overlooked. Didn't come from the best background. Went to schools that were considered actually sort of, sink schools and that kind of thing, Battersea County and whatever else. But I loved it. But as a result, I didn't have a lot of confidence. And so that just opened up, the other elements of my character that I kind of stuffed down and suppressed and tried to pretend, didn't exist. This kind of gave me license. It legitimized who I actually am, my authentic self. And I wasn't going to go back in the box.
Yeah, and that typical of that style, it's easily bored, needs a lot of variety, great starter, not always a great finisher, because you can so clearly conceptualize something that once you've seen it, you're done with it. I mean, now it would be too boring to actually do it. And then with the D style, again, you don't want to be known as the bossy lady, and so we very often fight ourselves, I always use the disc to try and get people talking about purpose, talking about themselves, accepting the fact that this is who they are and this is who they are not. And for you, there are no strangers. You love adventure. And interestingly enough, opposites already attract and always attract. And your husband would, in all probability be the exact opposite of that. And that's why God brings us together, so that we have various styles that we can look at one situation and see it from different perspectives. And I'm sure you've seen that play out many times in your marriage.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, interestingly enough, my husband is a D as well. So that sometimes, it's been a dance that we've had to learn to kind of give and take, and the whole butting of heads and things. But yes, we definitely come at things in a different way. I'm energized by being around people for the most part, and he's kind of more sort of introverted. And so we had to kind of, again, learn that, when we first got married, for example, it would be very easy for me to call up a friend and say, yeah, come round. And my friends being like very similar to me would come round, or my family would come round, and they'd bring everybody else. It's a Sunday, you're driving, you go stop off. We all kind of live in a reasonably same area. You stop off, and by the time it happens, 5 people are at your house, and my husband would be horrified. He'd be like, oh, my gosh. We didn't plan for this, and we didn't. And I'm like, who cares? We don't need to plan it, But so yeah, we've had to learn, but it's been a blessing, because, like you say, the learning to value and appreciate each other's differences is something that makes it work, because you show up with different things and you have different perspectives, and you don't get into this, I'm right, and stuck in this mode. And I think that again has been very helpful from a leadership perspective, because I expect people to show up with things that are different to me, and often fill the gaps that I don't have, those areas where I'm not strongest. I appreciate that.
Now, you said you're a governmental consultant, and our listeners maybe asking themselves, are you available to come to Washington, D.C.? But what exactly are you doing? I mean, are you working on software systems? Are you working on legislation? What's the emphasis of your consulting work that you're doing throughout the Caribbean?
Okay. It's a great question, because what you said earlier, that my type, my style, doesn't like to sort of just do one thing and like variety, and so I'm in the perfect job in that sense. So most of the time I'm working on public service transformation or public sector reform, and basically what that means is that I'm trying to help a government bring about their vision. And their vision can be as simple as wanting to be more effective and more efficient, which is kind of more about the reforms. You change structures, you might also put in place new or different legislation, particularly around governance. It could be just about changing the structure of the organization, so you break down silos and have this one government. And that's kind of more on the reform side, a lot of the institutional reform. But on the transformation, and on doing public service transformation, it's a little bit wider. It's not just a change of name. It means that we're not just trying to fix the public service or change the public service so that it functions better in and of itself, but that actually it functions better to be able to enable private sector-led growth and help the country to develop, so that those citizens, get more from it, and that they can fill their own potential. So, the public service transformation is very much in my wheelhouse. It allows me to work across a range of projects and lead those projects. So, for example, we might be working on digital transformation, we might be working on governance, which means we're working on various pieces of legislation, we might be working on customer service, and sort of allows me to kind of, have that variety, but also allows me to work with some great people and some great teams, and, do it in collaboration with them, because leadership is a team sport, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so how, if I can ask, how are you received as a woman in what is probably predominantly male oriented government? How's that going?
It's interesting because in the Caribbean, actually, we have a significant proportion of female leaders. Your senior public servants, public officers, civil servants. You also have a lot more women politicians. So, for example, I'm in Barbados, and we've had our first female prime minister, Honourable Mia Motley. And so, it's not atypical in the Caribbean. Mm-hmm. However, that said, I think that we still struggle with the piece about I sound very English, and more than whether I'm female or not female, I think, I have to go a long way of proving my sort of stripes, as it were, that I don't show up thinking that I'm better just because I sound English or I've lived in, in England or was educated in England. I have to show up, making it really clear that I'm, part of the society. I've lived here 15 years. And that I, I have a vested interest, which I do, I have family members and youngsters, and ultimately I want to see the Caribbean improve and be better. But that has been my biggest challenge, is, not being seen as somebody who's from over and away and doesn't really care about us and is just here to earn money, versus somebody who's in it with you and has a vested interest and wants to make, things better.
Yeah, so you have, you can establish some credibility that enhances the work that you're doing.
Yes, definitely. I mean, if you were to ask me, however, how I was received as a leader in the, in the UK, and I've worked on other projects, that's a different kettle of fish altogether, because we're still at the situation where, where, as a woman and as a black woman, I can tell you sometimes people find it really difficult to follow your lead or to even consider you as somebody who's their equal. So it's a very different, ball game. I have different challenges depending on the culture and the place that I'm working.
Yeah. If you're just tuning in, we're talking to Felicia Lynch. She is a governmental consultant in Barbados, comes from the UK. Her mom was from Barbados, dad from Nigeria, and she's been talking to us about the pandemic in Barbados and talking to us about her work. And now let's talk a little bit about your leadership work, and we're going to talk about your book, The Invisible Leader, Stepping Up, Stepping Out. Why a leadership book? Why write something about leadership in the context of what you're doing?
I think for me, that I wanted to, I mean, the thing, as I say in the book, is full of, people writing about leadership. But what I wanted to do was kind of show up in the space with a different perspective, in the sense that leadership is not about the title that you carry, you know, or where you are in the hierarchy, but about, you know, as I call it, being purposed for leadership. So somebody who has a goal or a vision that is bigger than themselves for the benefit of others. And so I wanted to be able to talk about that and people being leaders within that context, and specifically about people who may have been, you know, like me in my early walk, you know, afraid of stepping up or stepping out, or you know, acting upon that leadership gifting that they know that they've got innately, but are too frightened to sort of put themselves out there and take up that mantle.
So part of your title, The Invisible Leader, was your journey from feeling you had to be invisible, or people seeing you as just looking past you, to taking a more proactive, having a more proactive voice in the situations where you were. Is that correct?
Yes, and also sometimes I didn't believe it in myself. You know, I'd spent so long, sort of, like I said, you know, before I did the disc, you know, so long sort of being in a role and allowing the role to shape me and being frustrated in it. But the idea of then suddenly, you know, stepping out and being my authentic self was scary, you know. And like you said, you know, as a high D, you know, not wanting people to think of God as the bossy woman, but, you know, because that's how it can come across. And so, so yeah, so between other people's view of me because of how you look or where your background or whatever, and my own view of myself, you know, I was rendered invisible.
Yeah, and but then you really got into leadership studies. I mean, the thing when we first started working on the book, I mean, you were bringing it. I mean, you were very aware and very in tune with authors and theories and what I call leadership movements or emphases that were around there. When did that emerge, and how did you get so deeply into leadership studies?
I had always had an interest in people. And working in organizations, the one thing that, you know, became very clear for me, and this, in fact, this is the reason why I ended up doing an HR qualification, because after I left law, I realized that I had leaders, you know, when I was as a lawyer, that just didn't seem to be effective. And I could never work out why. So that started me on a journey of just reading, and also because I wanted to help, you know, myself become a better leader, because although I was a lawyer, I was a senior lawyer and I had juniors, and I was also, you know, responding to my leaders and realizing that, you know, what the way they were leading, I wasn't appreciating, and I didn't want to model that same style or that same way of leading. And I wanted to work out what was it. And it wasn't the charismatic leader. It wasn't about that. It was just, it was ineffective. It wasn't helping me to grow, but at the same time, it wasn't also leading to sort of, you know, the bottom line that we wanted to see within the company, et cetera. So that's when I started researching it. And then I decided, you know, I'm going to go and do an MBA. So I left the law firm and went to study an MBA. And so I took 2 years out, mortgaged my house, and said, I really need to look into this, and did that. And as I went along that journey, I also got more interested in people. When I was younger, you know, it was a toss-up when I actually came to do law. I'd actually wanted to do psychology. But, you know, sort of, you know, parental, you know, guidance and everything else. And I don't regret doing the law. I love it. I wouldn't be doing the work that I'm doing now if I didn't have that piece. But always had that interest in, you know, behavior and how we work and whatever. So between, you know, doing the MBA and my own experiences of leaders, I started to really research into this and start looking at how we, you know, how we behave and how impactful a leader can be to changing, to bringing change and transformation. So that was really where I started.
Now, the invisible leader stepping up, stepping out, to our listeners, if you go to the blog radio site for this show, to the page, The Invisible Leader is in pink. You can click on that, and it takes you to Amazon. It's available in paper and Kindle. Somebody gets the book, Felicia. What do you hope they get out of it? What can they expect when they work their way through The Invisible Leader?
I think the first thing is that they can expect is that it's not your typical book. It's not a book of sort of theories as such. It is my own personal experience. And I got asked a really great question the other day, which was, you wrote a book on leadership, and what I recognize is it's your experience, and you didn't sort of add anything else. You didn't write about, and this person or that person. And I said, that was part of my journey, which was that I always felt that I had to have my own learning legitimized by somebody else. And as a consultant and as a lawyer, that's very standard. If you write something, what's the source for it? Who said what? And it was So it was about me finding my own voice and finding that, I do have something to offer. Some things that can be applied generally, So that was the first thing, is that it's very much my story, and it's the good, the bad, and the ugly. I share the leadership in my leadership journey, the mistakes I've made, and I really wanted to do that. I think one of the things that we see often is that this idea that the leader is infallible and they never make mistakes, and that's just nonsense. If you're going to be a good leader, you're going to make mistakes. The issue is, what do you do with those mistakes? How do you respond to it, and what do you learn from it? And particularly for young leaders coming up, we talk about the millennials, and we often don't talk about them in a very positive way. And having sat down with my nieces and nephews, I've got two nieces and two nephews, and I get to chat with them and their friends. And what I realized as well is that I wanted them to see that, we've made mistakes, and you're not the sum of your mistakes, that actually if you make mistakes, you can learn from them, but more than that, you can move past them. So, my nephew was sharing with me, some of the things that he's done, and our auntie kitchen's so awful, and, it wasn't awful at all, and said that you guys are so accomplished. And I really wanted him and others like him to be able to realize, no, that's what you see today. You didn't see the journey. And I made some horrible mistakes, both in terms of leadership and also in my personal life. But God can redeem, and we can grow and learn from that.
Yeah. You emphasize a lot in your book about leaders as servants, and I'm sure in your work and my work, it seems like a contradiction in terms. If you're going to lead, then you can't serve, and if you're going to serve, you really can't be in leadership. The two are diametrically opposed. How do you put those two together, and how do they work out in the context of you're someplace and you're speaking to leaders, and you have to be a leader yourself, and you're trying to help governments improve themselves. How do we combine the leadership and the service? How does that work?
I think it starts from what we think, our sort of reframing of what we think, servant leadership is. We hear servant and we think of meek and lowly and, trodden upon, and that's not really what it's about. Coming from a servant leadership perspective, it's about having the heart of a servant. So it's about having a heart of humility that is actually saying, that you're not putting yourself higher than somebody else and thinking of yourself more highly than you ought to, and that you're there primarily to serve others. I love this definition of humility, because it then kind of made so much more sense for me, that humility is strength restrained. So you make a choice, we show up with the strength that we have, and but what we do is we make a choice to restrain it, so that we actually serve others and give them the best of what we who we are, when and as they as needed. And so when I show up, I don't show up trying to be meek and mild by any stretch. It's just not my personality. But I do show up coming from the perspective of everything that I do is driving towards helping you achieve your goal, this bigger goal. And it's because I'm for you. It's because I want to do the best for you, my big thing is, if people walk away and feel that, I was in it with them, that I wanted the best for them, then, you know, I've achieved, you know, what I wanted to achieve in terms of, you know, the heart of a servant. And I'm prepared to, you know, put, you know, things in order to do that. You know, if it means that I don't, you know, don't always have things right, or I don't always say, you know, don't always have to be right, as it were, or do things the way I would normally do them or would want to see them done because of the greater good and because it serves your purposes, then I'm going to do that. And so, you know, it's really about focusing on them first.
Yeah, and it's really, you know, I think your transparency where you're saying, you know, I've made mistakes, you're actually making what you've learned from those mistakes available to the people. That is such a tremendous service, you know, because too often I think we've seen people show up and they're pretending like they have it all together, and therefore it puts pressure on people to feel like they have to do the same thing. Now, certainly they want to hire us because we do have a level of expertise, or we can take them where they or go with them as they're heading for a chosen destination. But you're making yourself available to them, and you are serving them with your whole being. Is that an accurate summary?
Yeah, definitely. You know, I show up with all that I have. You know, I often go into a role, and it may be a specific thing, you know, a specific job title. But if I have the skills, capabilities, or whatever else, you know, I show up with my whole self. I'm willing to, you know, as a consultant, you know, we stay in scope. But if I'm there and you're paying me and this is what you need and I can do it, and, you know, I can, you know, to help you take something forward, I'm going to do it because I'm here to serve.
Yeah. In your book, you have at the end of your final chapter, before your concluding thoughts, it's holding others accountable, finding the balance. And your summary at the end is accountability is service and requires relationship. You wrote, this chapter takes a different view than normally presented concerning managing performance. The goal in performance management is to help people learn and grow, not to punish them for underperformance. Accountability is simply another aspect of service. When I did my coaching program, I learned that honor and practice involves support, encouragement, and accountability. This is easy when all is going well, but difficult to do when we have underperforming or difficult employees. Therefore, it requires us as leaders to build relationships of trust and to have relational capital. Performance management then becomes an ongoing conversation in an environment of justice and fairness that builds a culture of honor. But the statement that just jumps out at me is accountability is simply another aspect of service. How did you come to that conclusion? How did that become real in your leadership repertoire?
I think it became real for me because I realized that if I don't hold somebody accountable for the things that they're doing, then one, I stop their growth, I don't help them grow, and therefore it becomes a disservice to them. You know, I've always appreciated, I've learned to appreciate feedback, good and bad, you know, because if I don't get the feedback, one, I don't know, I'm not self-aware, you know, I don't become even greater, I don't have greater awareness, and two, I can't change the things I don't know about. And so in my own leadership journey, I have experienced that where, you know, I was doing things and didn't know it, and nobody, you know, nobody called me on it. They didn't hold me accountable. So I wasn't able to change. But I've also recognized and seen the value of where me as a leader, you know, of being able to hold other people accountable and show them, you know, that there's a better way, and that in holding you accountable, I'm doing this because I want to see your growth. I want to.
The call has dropped, and I think it's the internet, and so let us just, well, we got almost all the way through the interview, so let me just send a text to Felicia here, and this is the second time this week I've lost internet. There's not. I see she's back. So let's try. Hi, are you there?
I am indeed.
Good. I thought maybe it was my end because I lost a show a couple days ago because I lost internet. It's not a problem. Thank you for calling back. So we were talking about accountability, and you learned, you know, people didn't hold you accountable, to, and it didn't help you, did it?
No, not at all. You know, it's hard when to receive feedback, but, you know, one of the things I can say is that I've grown the most when I've had feedback, and you don't grow from the good feedback.
Mm-hmm.
You grow from the feedback that's developmental, that stretches you, that gets you, that challenges you to do things differently, to see a different perspective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you share some great stories in the book of how you learned that, you know, and I always felt I had to serve people by even sometimes helping them get to the better place where they could be more productive than they are now. So even if I had to help somebody make a transition, I was serving them. And I think you make the point in what we just read. It's not punitive, is it? It's really it's in their best interest for us as leaders to do that, isn't it?
It is, definitely. You know, I had an experience where when I was a lawyer, and I talk about it in the book, where we failed an audit. It was a very significant audit because it was a government audit that if we don't make our numbers, the standards, then we could get our license taken away to do legal aid work. Anyway, particular department, the leader, you know, had made some significant errors, and we were in a situation where we needed to address them. And so my approach to him was to point out the errors, but to say, listen, I want to sit with you and work out how we can move forward, and we need to, you know, remedy these things before we have the assessments coming back, and let's work on that together. And the head of the law firm at the time, so, you know, we have that conversation. He says, yeah, I know, we need to get on with this. He comes in and says, you didn't, you know, he was in the conversation. He says, you didn't blast him. You didn't, you know, he just felt like I should have shouted at him and told him that this is going to cost. And I said, one, how would that have helped us? I said, because we need him right now to focus in order to be able to fix the things and remedy the things. So I said, if I'd have taken that approach, how would that have helped? I said, but number two, do we just want to punish him? I said, what's the outcome? What's the result that we want? We want him to know this was really serious and he needs to take it seriously. We want him to know that he needs to do better, you know, next time. And we want him to know how to change. So if I'd sat there shouting and, you know, all the rest of it, he wouldn't have been in a learning mode, and I wouldn't have been able to talk to him about, okay, how can we, you know, figure out a way to make this better, you know, to change it and whatever else. And, you know, and so I learned, you know, especially in that situation, you know, a few weeks later, he comes back and he's made all the changes and he's, you know, he's apologetic. You don't have to rap people over the head, you know, and make them feel guilty or any of that, because that's not the point. It's about what, you know, if it really performance management and accountability is actually helping somebody to change for the better, and to do it better next time, then we always have to keep that in mind.
Yeah. Yeah. So the invisible leader, stepping up, stepping out, looking down the table of contents, chapter one, leaders don't fail, failing forward. Chapter two, turning the corner, finding the courage to move forward. Chapter three, purpose for leadership, the journey of self-awareness. Chapter four, leadership, what does it take? Chapter five, labels, it's all about identity. Chapter six, do I really have to serve? Chapter seven, holding others accountable, finding the balance. And again, go to Amazon.com, just put in Felicia Lynch, LINCH, or go to the blog radio page, the description for this show. Click on the pink link, The Invisible Leader, Stepping Up, Stepping Out, and you can order your paper or your Kindle copy. What else? We've got just about 5 minutes. What else about leadership did you want to say today in your time with our listeners?
I think what's really interesting is that we're going into a very different time. You know, we're hearing a lot of talk about the new normal and what's that going to look like. And, you know, I talk a lot. I mean, one of the things I say in the book, as I said, is that leadership isn't about your title, but, you know, a leader has to be able to, you know, inspire people. You can't necessarily motivate somebody, but you can inspire them, you know, to want to do something differently or better. Serve, which we talked about, and to connect. And being, you know, connecting is about being relational. And so in this new environment, those things are going to become even more important. And so we have to really think as leaders, how do we connect with our people and be relational in a situation or in a time where so much of what we're going to be doing now isn't face-to-face and it's virtual. And And I think that, you know, there's a tendency in even on a face-to-face to leave out the connecting bit. It's like, oh, we come to work. I don't have to be their friends. I don't want to get into that. You know, but the fact is people are people. You know, they show up as a whole person. This notion that we should leave our stuff, you know, the stuff of life at the door and show up to work as if we're robots is just an anathema, because that's not who we are. We're not robots. You know, we're created living beings. And I think the connection piece is going to become even more important now in a sort of virtual environment than it was before. And so how leaders now start to address that going forward is going to be really important. You know, it's not enough to say, well, you know, I'm all about the results and I'm not a people person. Nobody's saying that you need to be a people person. You just need to be able to relate, you know, and connect with people and make them feel important and not make them, you know, it's a curious term when we say human resource, because it's almost like saying you're like a photocopier, as opposed to saying, you know, no, we're managing people, not widgets. So, you know, we need to care about how they show up and, you know, are they okay in this time?
Yeah, yeah. How can people get in touch with you? How can our listeners get in touch with you or learn more about Felicia Lynch?
Okay, so they can go to my website, which is www.felicialynch.com. They can also go to my business website, which is www.kitch-cc.com, or find me on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Just look for Felicia Lynch and you'll find me.
Yes, and the Lynch is with an I, Felicia Lynch,
yes.
L-I-N-C-H. So FeliciaLynch.com or Kitch, K-I-T-C-H, -cc.com, K-I-T-C-H-cc.com. Got about 2 minutes. I know you are a movie aficionado, and all this time you've got to be watching some movies. Tell me what you're watching.
What have I watched lately? Trying to think. I watched so many.
Yeah, I know you do.
What did I watch last week? We watched, completely slipped me. We watched, you got me there. Let me try and look at Netflix and tell you what I've been watching. We watched very recently the Churchill, stuff like that. We watched The Queen with what's her name? English actress. She did The Pride of Miss Jean Brodie. But that was great. I've been very much into this sort of Netflix series, The Crown, and just looking at how that played out. And we watched the Le Mans, the 66, is it 66? With Ford versus Ferrari. Brilliant. Really, really good. Interesting to see how that went.
And what's the book on your nightstand, or what's the book on your desk? Are you reading anything?
I am. I have several at the moment. I'm reading a book by Johnny and Elizabeth Enlow, which is Rise, which is a Reformers in Society handbook, and it's about the role of the church and you know, bringing, you know, kingdom here on earth. I'm reading Robert Reimer, I think is how you pronounce his name, The Seven Transformations to a Healthy Soul. What else have I got? Books all over the place. I'm also reading... what else? Let me think what the most recent leadership book that I've read. I mentioned the book on, what's her name? Jenny Catron, The Four Dimensions of Leadership. Love that book.
I know you're a reader, so I knew you'd have something nearby, but I want to encourage our listeners to put on their nightstand or end table the Invisible Leader Stepping Up, Stepping Out. Felicia, thanks so much for your time. My best to Andrew.
Thank you.
And I haven't forgotten, we're going to collaborate on a book, so we'll be getting together here someday soon. All righty.
Thank you very much. Take care.
All righty. Take care. God bless. Bye-bye. All right, Felicia Lynch, FeliciaLynch, LINCH.com. Check her out. And the book, The Invisible Leader, Stepping Up, Stepping Out. Tomorrow, Bill Rhodes interviewing me. Send your questions or call in live. You get a chance to ask your question. We'll talk to you tomorrow. So long for now.
Thanks again for listening to Wake Up to Purpose with John Stanko. To get in touch with John, you can go to www.purposequest.com or write him at johnstanko@gmail.com.